also is a good thing, I think, for feeding programs at USDA.
The cranberry products will likely be distributed to school lunch programs and food pantries. Lochner says prices for consumers may increase while the market stabilizes. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A memorial service was held yesterday for little Serenity Rose, the 11-month-old girl allegedly killed by her father last week. Kenosha News reports that members of the community came together to support the girl's family. The funeral services were donated, as was her burial plot. WGTD News Time now, 8:10, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg. Quick check on sports and weather. NFL Monday Night Football, Baltimore beat New Orleans, the Bills beat the Jets. NBA, the Bucks were off last night, the Bulls beat Utah. Tonight, the Bucks host Detroit, the Bulls are in Denver. The forecast from the National Weather Service for this Tuesday, November 25th. Cloudy for the morning, partly sunny for the afternoon. Today's high 28. It's 22 in Racine and Kenosha, 19 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind chill 9 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath at 8:11. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and one of the hosts of the WGTD morning show.
I am so pleased to be connecting on today's morning show with Lissa Warren. She is someone well known to me in kind of a behind-the-scenes sort of way. Lissa Warren is someone with whom I'm able to book a number of morning show interviews, particularly with authors for Da Capo Press. And some of my favorite interviews over the last several years have been with Da Capo Press authors. Well, now I have the pleasure of speaking with Lissa Warren directly. Not in relation to anybody else, but about her own book, a wonderful book that she has written, a memoir called The Good Luck Cat, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat. This book is a very tenderly written memoir about Lissa Warren, her mother and her father, their small, close-knit family, and the cat, the gorgeous cat named Ting, which enters their lives and makes a very, very deep difference, particularly in the life of her father, but in all of their lives as well. And it's a book that I just enjoyed on so many different levels. And despite the fact that there's in a sense, no shortage of books like it before the public, there is something very special, uniquely insightful about this book, which I think makes it very special indeed. So I'm excited to be able to speak with Lissa Warren about her book, again called The Good Luck Cat, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat. It's published by Lions Press. And Lissa Warren, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be with you.
I wonder if you could just say a word about the different hats that you wear, that you, in your capacity with Da Capo Press, work with other authors all the time about their books, with their books, helping to publicize their books, and now here you are with a book of your own. And at some point in the memoir, you talk a little bit about your own background in terms of what you studied and your own aspirations. Can you help us sort of sort out what all of this kind of means for you professionally and personally?
Sure. I was an English education major undergrad, and then in graduate school I got my master's in fine arts and creative writing with a focus on poetry. For a living, I work at DiCapo Press, which is part of the Perseus Books Group, which is the country's largest independent publisher. I'm their VP of publicity, so it's my job to try to get our authors' books reviewed in major newspapers and magazines, and try to get our authors on the radio and on television talking about their books. So that's what I do for a living, and this time I decided to write my own book. So now I'm the one who's doing the interviews, not the one who's setting the interviews up.
It must be strange to be sitting on the other side of the table, I should think.
It's different, but it's fun. It's a nice change. It really is.
Hmm. One of the things I appreciated about this book, this memoir, is that it's about several different things, and yet the book has a wonderful cohesiveness. I mean, it's about a cat, it's about you, it's about your dad, it's about your mom, it's about contending with ill health, it's about contending with grief and loss, it's about the special dynamics of a small family, somehow it all kind of comes together. I wonder, as you first began writing this book, did you have kind of this clear vision of exactly what it should be about, or of what its focus should be?
Gosh, I wish I could say that I did. I was as surprised by some of the twists and turns that it took. I kind of wrote it in real time, as a lot of those twists and turns were actually taking place in my life. I didn't know exactly what it would be in the end, but I'm very glad to hear that you feel it's cohesive. That was always my goal, to somehow pull all the disparate items together.
Hmm. So describe to our listeners this exceptionally beautiful cat which came into your family's life. And it wasn't the first cat. First there was a cat named Cinnamon.
That's correct.
But
I grew up with a Burmese, a beautiful cat named Cinnamon, a sable Burmese, sweet, gentle, loyal cat. When we lost her, you know, after a year or so, we wanted to adopt another cat, but we felt we had had our Burmese. So we looked at other breeds, and we found a breed called a Korat, K-O-R-A-T. They're also from Thailand, like a Burmese, but they look quite different. They're a silver gray. With green, luminous eyes. They say they're the color of a lotus leaf. It's a really storied breed and revered breed in Thailand. King Rama V used to have state funerals for his favorites when they died. So we called the breeder in North Carolina. We asked for a female runt of the litter because we're tiny people and we like female cats. And lo and behold, she had one, and we were able to adopt her and name her King Pei Warren.
Hmm. Tell us about that moment when you actually drove to pick her up, because this ended up being a pickup that nearly didn't occur.
Yeah, the breeder from North Carolina was going to be in New Jersey for a cat show, and so we agreed to meet there. But when I got there, unbeknownst to me, they had shown her to judges that morning, and she had won ribbons. In fact, she had won several ribbons. I'm not sure what the breeders saw in her that made them think that she wasn't a show-quality cat, maybe a little kink in the tail or some little banding somewhere, but for whatever reason, they didn't think they had a show cat on hand, and the judges thought they did. So then they wanted to keep the cat and breed the cat. But I had driven all that way, and more importantly, my mom and dad were waiting at home for the new addition to our family, and I didn't want to disappoint them, and I would have been so disappointed myself because I was looking so forward to having the cat too. But luckily for me, when they handed the cat to me, just so I could hold her and see her, she licked my nose, and it was just clear to everyone that she was a Warren. She was meant to come home with me.
Hmm. One of the reasons why there was, in some ways, almost a sense of urgency about this was really had to do with your father, and ultimately one of the most important roles that Ting played in your family's life was the benefit that she could be rather directly, rather concretely to your father. in terms of his own health and happiness and well-being. Tell us about sort of your father's state around the time that Ting came into your lives and the kind of difference that you think Ting made to him.
My dad had had a bypass a few years before we adopted Ting, and all of the grafts in the bypass didn't take. So his heart wasn't working the way that a heart should work. He was able to get around and function, but he didn't have a lot of energy. He spent a lot of time at home, you know, sitting and doing crossword puzzles, sitting and watching baseball games. My mom worked full-time still. I worked full-time. My dad was home alone a lot. So when we got Ting, we really did so with the hope that she would be a companion for him and that she would help elevate his mood because, you know, obviously when you're limited physically in what you're able to do, you can become depressed. And we did start to see a little bit of that in my father and were very concerned. And so the cat was a constant companion for him, but also fun for him and amusement for him and something that cheered him up considerably. She was very much needed by my father, and they were such a great team. They were just a wonderful combination, the two of them, joined at the hip. Literally, he would carry her around on his hip. Mm-hmm.
You also talk about how having someone like Ting, your beautiful cat, just in the house had an effect on the entire household and you as a family. At one point you say there's something about having a cat to take care of that regulates a family. Ting's basic needs and predictable habits coupled with her expectations for slow movements and soft tone superseded any desire we might otherwise have had for excitement. And that was fine with us. She had a calming effect on the house. Tell us more about the ways in which Ting had this effect of, in a sense, regulating and calming your household.
She is just a tiny little cat who doesn't like swift movements. And so we would literally tiptoe around her when we first got her home until she acclimated a little more fully to life with us. You know, we would slow our movements. We would talk in low tones. It just made for a very gentle home, a very peaceful home, and I can't help but think that my father benefited from that health-wise. It was what he needed. It was she provided a rhythm to our day, and it was, you know, kind of a nice, slow, quiet rhythm, which is what he needed. That constancy of having her there was a very good thing for him, too. Just knowing where she would be, even at a certain time of the day, like at 3 o'clock, she likes a rocker by the window, but at noon, she prefers to be lounging on the hardwood floors where the sun comes in and the beams of the floors are warm. You know, so just knowing where to look for her throughout the day and what room she would be in, and then you'd figure out from that what room you'd be in because you'd want to be with her. It was just kind of a beautiful, beautiful life, beautiful way to live.
Hmm. Many times through the course of the book, we see the word ritual. And it's interesting. I'd never stopped to really think about the different way in which one might utilize the term ritual, not to describe what we typically think of with that word in terms of some kind of rather a official or maybe even religious event or ceremony, but those practices which become a very important part of one's daily life, even if that ritual has to do with feeding the cat, for instance.
Yeah, it's the smallest thing. It's remembering to change her water every morning, you know, or refilling it, topping it off every night when it's getting low, putting down her food for her, and then looking to see how much of it she's eaten and if maybe she needs a little bit more. You know, just even turning the rocking chair so that the sun shines right in on it, she can lounge right on it. Those little things, it's, you know, they make your life what it is. They're the things that kind of anchor your day. She very much would anchor our days for us.
Hmm. We're speaking with Lissa Warren, and we're talking about her book called The Good Luck Cat, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat. One of my favorite stories that you tell comes in the chapter where you're also talking about the fact that one of your parents was Jewish and the other was Catholic, So for you growing up, there was this religious sort of blendedness, and for instance, your family would celebrate both Hanukkah and Christmas, and so did Ting in some memorable ways, including a rather spectacular encounter with your Christmas tree that you describe in pretty exciting detail.
She shimmied up to the top of the Christmas tree. It took her days of trying to actually get up there. And she is, you know, silver gray, as I mentioned, so it was almost like when she got to the top, there was this silver star shining from the highest bough. It was beautiful for about 10 seconds, and then the entire Christmas tree came crashing down with her on top of it, and all of the ornaments just scattered across the room. So, you know, she was like that. I mean, you'd be having a beautiful, calm, quiet day, and then she would do something that would just flip it on its head. My mother had these little china mice that she used to put out on top of the mantle at Christmas time. They were all Christmas-themed, you know, mouse in the manger and mouse making a snowman. And one night from upstairs, we heard this little sort of crashing sound. And my mother looked at me and said, oh, it must be icicles falling off the roof. And then the next morning, she went downstairs and saw the mass grave of little china mice all over the living room floor, because Ting had hopped up on the mantle and systematically pawed off mouse after mouse after mouse. Those are the kinds of things that she would do on a regular basis. They were amusing. They were a hassle. You know, they were all the things that cats can be, and she embodied all of it.
Hmm. One really memorable chapter in the book is called Ting is Missing, and just from the title of the chapter, we can, we already sort of know, even before we've read a single word more, about what this involves. It's an instance in which your parents, who actually, it sounds like, very seldom traveled, were gone, and so you were there at home with Ting, and Ting ultimately goes missing. And it's really amusing, although also for you at the time had to be terrifying, when you are really tearing the house apart from stem to stern, desperately trying to find the Ting.
I thought I had lost their baby when they were in Africa on safari. It was one big trip that they decided to take. My dad got clearance from his doctors to do it. You know, they saved up for it and planned it out methodically so that he'd be able to make the trip. And they called from Africa on a solar phone check and see how Ting was, and of course that was the night that Ting had gone missing. I faked it. I pretended all was well. I didn't want to terrify them so far away when there was nothing they could do, but indeed for several hours I couldn't locate Ting. I looked everywhere. I looked in the craziest, silliest places. I, you know, raised the toilet lid to look and see if somehow she'd gotten in. I checked cupboards. I checked every closet. I checked drawers.
You checked the bread machine to make sure she hadn't crawled inside.
I checked the bread machine. I checked the microwave. I mean, it was just ridiculous. Places she couldn't even possibly fit, I checked them. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll get the stepladder from the garage and go and look on top of some of the things that were too high up for me to, you know, on my tiptoes see. And as I was getting that ladder out of the garage, I saw out of the corner of my eye something move and heard something, and I bent down and I looked under the car, and there was Miss Ting Pei Warren covered in leaves and something that looked like oil but wasn't, and I mean she was just all matted and messed up, and I felt like the world's most terrible mother to her. Brought her in, and you know, religious bathing of the cat ensued. You can imagine.
And I just realized now I kind of misspoke. I described all your family as homebodies. In fact, your mother and father loved to travel and traveled quite a lot. You're the homebody who really...
I'm the homebody. My dad was a bit, too. My mom really, really loves to travel, and she would kind of drag him along with her. And he'd have a good time in the end, but it was always her prodding him to get out there. And she just wanted him to live his life as fully as he could for as long as he could, so... it came from the right place, certainly, but yeah, they went to China, they went to Ireland, you know, what little energy my dad had, he would kind of save it up, and he would then try to travel with my mom and keep her company.
I appreciated the time that you took talking about how we refer to the animals that live with us. And you say that, in fact, you're not a big fan of the word pet, and prefer another slightly more sort of complex term that you think better describes the relationship that, for instance, you and your parents had with Ting. Explain, first of all, sort of your reservations about the word pet and the term that you maybe prefer.
Sure. To me, pet somehow sounds less than. It diminishes what a cat can be, or for that matter, I think what a dog can be. You know, they are parts of a family. Pet suggests ownership to me. I don't think of myself as the owner of a cat. I think of myself as the mother to a cat. I didn't buy the cat, even though, you know, dollars were exchanged. I adopted the cat. So to me, the pet term just doesn't quite do it. I use the term companion animal, which I know is a little highfalutin sounding and funny. I mean, you wouldn't call your husband a companion man, you know, but to me, the term companion animal is just more gentle and more accurate somehow.
Right. You write, it does at least come closer to expressing her place in our lives. It offers a certain respect. It's a nod to what every person who loves cats knows, that life would be much lonelier without them, and that while they weren't put on this planet just to keep us company, they do so with a skill and devotion that very few humans can match, that very few humans would try to. And you also say you like the term because it sounds reciprocal, the fact
yes.
that not only is Ting your companion, but you are her companions as well.
Yeah, I wear that title proudly, believe me.
We're speaking with Lissa Warren about her book, The Good Luck Cat, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat. One of the most painful portions of this story, of this memoir, comes in late 2008 when your beloved father dies of a heart attack. One of the things I wanted to ask you about that is what it was like to relive what had to be a really terrible experience, and was there any comfort or any sense of closure in revisiting it and writing about it? And was writing about it maybe harder or easier than you anticipated it to be?
I avoided it. The last chapter that I wrote was the chapter where my father died. I wrote around it. I did everything I could to not have to write that chapter. I even wondered if there was a way that I could somehow tell our family story without having to write that chapter, but there wasn't. And so I wrote it. I wrote it as honestly and accurately as I could. I wrote it with a lot of tea to keep me awake so that I could just get it done in one fell swoop, and that is really how I wrote it. It was cathartic in its way. I think anytime you write about something that is an incredibly hard thing to go through, there is some catharsis there. But I still miss them. You know, I still miss them on a daily basis, and I don't read that chapter. I don't go back and read that chapter. There are other chapters in the book that I enjoy going back and reading and remembering, but I avoid that one like the plague. I do. I think I always will.
Right. One of the most touching moments in that chapter about your father's hospitalization, of course, his ultimate death, was that this seemed to be a moment when you first were so acutely aware of how small your family was.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe in a way that you hadn't ever been so fully conscious. I mean, you were so conscious, especially that night in the hospital, of being an only child. Tell us more about how this moment was really revelatory for you in this respect, in this aspect of your life.
I am an only child. We are a small family. My mother was an only child as well. I lost half my family in one night when my dad died. And, you know, we have Ting, our cat, and she's family too, but I guess a more accurate way to put it would be I lost half my human family the night that my dad died. And I, you know, remember looking at my mom after my dad died and thinking to myself, I am now responsible for her. I will be the one to take take care of her when she needs taken care of. And, you know, it is an honor to be that person who gets to do that for her, but it is also a weight and a responsibility. And I'm sure that every only child, you know, feels that and can relate to that. But you don't realize how small your family is until you lose an integral part of it, and then you become acutely aware of it.
Right. You also say, I think so poignantly, that someday when both your mother and father are gone, you realize that that certain stories would begin to wink out of existence, and that once you're gone, no one at all is probably going to remember certain things that were a really important part of your family's life together. We just don't often think about that. I think reading that, probably people appreciate their own families and in that sense of legacy that maybe they wouldn't otherwise.
Yeah, legacy is a good word for it.
One thing that, of course, added to the pain of your father's death, sudden death, is the fact that tied up in it was the possibility, more than a possibility in your mind, that he did not receive the very best or most attentive care he could have received. I wonder if you could just say a word about what role that played in this loss, and to this very day, if that continues to make it difficult for you to sort of process this loss.
The doctors did miss the warning signs. In retrospect, it was abundantly clear that he was heading for a massive coronary, but they thought that some other medical problems that he was having were the reason that he was feeling, you know, pain in his left arm and tightness in his jaw, and they just missed it. We were and are angry at the doctors who missed it, but at the same rate, my mom and I were right there too. We know him better than anyone. We knew him better than anyone. And so we felt horribly guilty that we didn't pick up on it more quickly and fast enough to intervene and do something to help him. And that's a guilt that we will always have with us, that we do still have with us. But, you know, there's nothing productive from guilt. There's nothing good that comes from it. So we do our best to push it to the back of our minds and just make up for that by taking care of each other.
Hmm.
My mom and I do.
Right. And taking care of Ting, because you proceed from there to...
Yeah, she was his baby, and we do feel like even though we couldn't save my father, we were able to save his cat.
Mm. Your cat displays what had to be absolutely terrifying, strange physical symptoms. I think you're the one who spots them first. Describe to our listeners what you saw with Ting one day, and what ultimately the problem turned out to be.
Yeah, she was sitting on a pillow, and she just fell completely off it and was unconscious, it seemed like, for just a split second. And then she kind of came to and righted herself and just kind of sat there quietly for a little bit, not seeming quite like herself. We didn't know exactly what was going on, so we just watched her very closely, and then like an hour later, she did the same thing. We knew that something was wrong, and so we took her to our family vet, who listened to her heart rate and said, wow, it's really low. It's slow like a dog's heart, slow. And it turns out that Ting has a very serious heart condition called second-degree AV block. So within the same year that we lost my dad to a heart attack, his cat was diagnosed with a potentially fatal heart condition of her own. And we were told that in order to survive, she needed a pacemaker, but they don't make pacemakers for cats. So we were referred to Angel Animal Medical Center in Boston, where they implanted a human pacemaker in Ting.
It's an amazing story, and one of the things that's actually really pretty ironic in some ways is the almost beautiful level of care which Ting receives. I mean, at least the way you describe it, she is the subject of tremendous and tender attentiveness, it seems, at every step of the way, as are you and your mother as well. We sort of marvel at that, and in some respects can't help but contrast that with the way in which you and your mother and father were treated in this very unhappy episode, which ultimately led to your father's death.
Yeah, it was fortunate that we got her to the animal hospital we got her to, where they had a cat cardiologist, where they had a pain management specialist, where they had nurses who were with her round the clock in kind of an intensive care unit. She was given so much close and careful and loving attention. And when she wouldn't eat at that hospital, just because there were so many unfamiliar sights and sounds and smells around her, we brought her home and we force-fed her because that was all we could do. We used a syringe to squirt cat food, wet cat food, down her throat, and that was how we kept her alive until we could get her eating again on her own. We made our bed on the floor so that we could sleep beside her, so that if she woke up in the middle of the night and was a little discombobulated, we would be there to help her. We would hold the water glass up to her so that she could drink it, and not have to bend too far forward and risk, you know, being dizzy. And we just made her life our life for the period of time that we needed to while she was convalescing.
Hmm. And you say that taking care of her was a team effort more than ever before. You say that if your mom and you ever felt tempted to kind of get into the typical squabbles that even a loving mother and daughter do, you just, in your words, had to bury the hatchet. We have a cat who needs us. If we want to take out our grief on each other, we can't. We need each other too much, and Ting needs us to work together. It probably doesn't always work out that way, or people don't figure that out, but it's probably very good for Ting that you and your mother figured that out, that you needed to really work together to, in a sense, nurse her back to health.
It was very good for Ting, but it was very good for my mom and I, too, you know?
Right. I mean, in fact, this is probably one of the places where your book really lives up to its subtitle, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat. It's
exactly
this experience right here. It's quite an amazing story. I don't know how much of this you want to talk about, so I'm going to be very cagey with the way I pose this last question. Your book ends rather surprisingly with a discovery that you end up making about your own health. And I wonder if you could just say a word about, I mean, however much you want to say, about how this folds into this whole experience and how it helps you maybe see other events in your own life and in your family's life, maybe through a different lens.
Sure. I'm totally comfortable talking about it, Greg. I mean, it's a part of who I am now. I woke up one morning and my left leg was numb, and I thought I'd maybe slept on it a little funny. And then I woke up the next morning and my left arm was numb, and I thought, maybe I pinched a nerve. The next day, the right side of my face was numb, and the next day, my tongue started to go numb, and that's when I thought, okay, something's wrong here. Long story short, within 24 hours of going to a walk-in clinic to figure out what was wrong with me, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and it is a disease that I will always have. It is chronic. It is progressive. It is, at the moment, incurable, although there's certainly reason to believe that they'll cure it in my lifetime. You know, when you get a diagnosis like that, it's terribly frightening, but at the same rate, it helps you to see very clearly how much you have to live for and who you have to live for. And, you know, I look at my mom and I look at the cat and I know that they need me. And I know that I need to be brave and I need to be strong and take as good care of myself as I possibly can so that I'm able to take care of them. You know, I would much rather not have MS. But I do see sort of the gifts of it, too. It helps you to understand the difference between people who care about you and people who will actually take care of you. You know, because my mom takes care of me now just like I take care of her. And Ting, the cat, takes care of me just like I take care of her, because on days when I'm not feeling so well and need companionship and need sort of a comforting presence, the cat's right there to be that for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, she is the good luck cat, and that we were able to save her But in a way, by the end of the book, I'm feeling like a good luck cat myself, even though I got this really tough diagnosis, because it has helped me to see all of the good things I have and how fortunate I actually am to have the life that I have.
Right. One of the things you say is that having MS made you much more sensitive than you might otherwise be to the struggles of other people. And not just in a kind of a touchy-feely way, because I think often when we ourselves have struggles, then we're just in a sense more sensitive to how someone else might be suffering. But I think you also mean that maybe even more in a really tangible way, that it helps you notice the people around you who in one way or another might be struggling, particularly in sort of physical ways.
Yeah, there are people with canes everywhere. I never realized it. There are people who limp. There are people who have, you know, physical limitations that I just somehow never saw. Now I see them, and I look right at those people, and I smile with them because I get what their life is like. I know how hard it is when it's icy out to have a little trouble walking, and I know how important it is that somebody clear that ice or clear that snow. Now when I see somebody pull into a handicapped spot, I keep an eye on them for a second just to make sure they're okay and that they don't need any help. And, you know, usually they're just fine, but I just try to be there just in case, because that could be me someday, and, you know, someday I might need a hand to help me get out of the car. So it does help you to, a diagnosis like the one that I got, it does help you to see other people who may be struggling, and it does instill in you a desire to help them any way that you possibly can.
I also really appreciated the moment when you say that in talking with a sales rep friend and revealing the fact that you've just been diagnosed with MS. Tell our listeners what this sales rep said to you.
He said, "You're kidding, me too." It turns out this man who I had known for 13 years had had multiple sclerosis the whole time, and I had no idea. And that was a wonderful thing, because it showed me that you could still live a totally vibrant life with MS. And so it was very helpful for me to see that, to see him thriving. But it also just made me feel so bad, because this dear person who I was close to had been, you know, struggling in little ways all these years, and I had no idea. I had never done a darn thing to help him. I had probably, you know, said cheerfully sometimes, "Oh, well, let's just walk to the restaurant for dinner tonight," when maybe that wouldn't have been the best bet. Maybe we should have taken a cab those 10 blocks instead. You know, so it was eye-opening for me. There are people all around who have health issues that may not be visible health issues, but are still things that you know, you should try to be wary of and be aware of, and try to help them any way that you can.
Hmm. Explain to our listeners why the chapter you talk about this in is titled Manuscript. I mean, the chapter in the book where you talk about being diagnosed with MS, the title of the chapter is Manuscript.
Yeah, because I work in publishing. In publishing, you use the abbreviation MS when you're talking about manuscripts. Manuscripts that are due, manuscripts that are being turned over to production. You just write MS to production. So for me, when I see the two letters on a page, MS, the first thing I think of is manuscript. And I hope for the rest of my life that the first thing I think of when I see those two letters next to each other is manuscript.
Hmm. Because as you say, at some point, you do not want your MS to become you, or you do not want to become MS. You are much more than that. And,
I'm okay with it being a part of me, but I never want it to be all I am.
Hmm. Well, this beautiful book, once again, is called The Good Luck Cat, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat. It is published by Lions Press, and the book includes a number of really lovely photographs of this beautiful cat named Ting at the heart of Lissa Warren's family. Lissa Warren, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show, and thank you for writing such a lovely book, even as the owner of two golden retrievers who's never owned a cat. I thoroughly enjoyed this book so much, and I'm really grateful for this opportunity to talk with you about it. Best wishes to you.
Thank you. You too. Give those golden retrievers a big kiss for me.
We finish out today's morning show by playing an excerpt from an interview a number of years ago, which I did with Charles D. Cohen, the author of a book called The Seuss, The Whole Seuss and Nothing But the Seuss, a visual biography of Theodore Seuss Geisel, published by Random House. In the book, Charles Cohen explores the varied career of Theodore Geisel, who of course went on to become one of the best known and most admired authors of children's books in history. One of the most interesting things which Charles Cohen does in his book is trace the development of certain iconic Dr. Seuss stories, like Horton Hatches the Egg.
It's a great story. People would ask him, of course, how he came up with his ideas, and one of the ones he told was about Horton Hatches the Egg. And he varied it over 30, 35 years, which was the first thing that led me to believe that it probably probably wasn't exactly the truth. Again, he's a wonderful storyteller, and he enjoyed that more than he enjoyed the truth often. So the basic story was that he had a sketch of an elephant, a sketch of a tree, and what he told his biographers in 1995, who were friends of his for 30 years and enjoyed hearing his stories, Judith and Neil Morgan, that he told them that he left the window open, went out for a walk on the day after New Year's in 1940, and then when he came back, the wind had blown one sketch on top of the other, and he came back and saw the elephant in the tree, and bingo, he's got this great idea. But if you do the research and say, well, wait a minute, there are a lot of versions. Let me track down the facts of this story. Go to the New York Times and find out that actually the temperature that day was -5 degrees with the wind chill outside his apartment. It's not window up and go for a walk weather. And he had told that same anecdote several years earlier, and it was happening in the spring, summer area. So it's a lot of fun to go through first and find out, okay, that isn't true. So now what really did happen? And that particular story developed over a 10-year period, and we try to show through some of the 700 images that we have in this book the progression, the way he would work with different animals out of context, a whale up in a tree or different animals with eggs. You get to the point where at one point you have an elephant on an egg and it just smashes it. 2 years before the book actually came out, he did a story called Matilda, the Elephant with a Mother Complex, and it's the exact same story that we're familiar with, of the elephant and the bird flying off and the elephant trying to hatch the egg, but has the exact opposite outcome. In the end, they think Matilda is an idiot for trying to hatch this egg. The bird flies off with no gratitude, the child, that is. So you can see that no matter what he told as the story, it's very clear that he was working and honing and changing this idea until he got to the great story we now remember.
It's good that you give us that fable, Matilda the Elephant with a Mother Complex, in its entirety. It's actually mostly text with really just two illustrations and then a moral at the very end of it. Moral, don't go around hatching other folks' eggs.
It's great to be speaking with someone, by the way, who has seen the book since it comes out today. It's wonderful that someone's been able to already read some and hopefully enjoy it.
Oh, it's a sheer delight. It really, really is. And it is really, in particular, so fun to see the evolution of certain ideas when all we know is the finished form,
exactly.
The book which ended up in our hands as youngsters, to see the twists and turns that the story took as it evolved over time. You've done all of us a real service here.
Thank you. And what you were saying about the pleasure of being able to see the whole piece, I think that's important if you're really going to get an understanding. And the book itself, when you're dealing with a biography, tends to be geared above average child's interest, although he as an author is of interest to children. So I wanted to have things that people could read to kids, like that story, or later in the book, the other one that we were able to publish in its entirety that people wouldn't be familiar with is called Speedy Boy. And we published portions of other really fun stories that people have forgotten about because they were never published again in books. There's a story called Tad and Todd about identical twins. Some of them are just marvelous, and I really felt this as we got into all the research and things for the book. It was this feeling of responsibility that came up to not let these things be lost to time.
We're speaking with Charles D. Cohen, and we're talking about his book called The Seuss, The Whole Seuss, and Nothing But the Seuss, a visual biography of Theodore Seuss Geisel. You at some point in the book take great pains to say that this is not a thorough biography of Theodore Geisel, and yet you do give us some helpful background information on who he was, his family, where he grew up, and in particular, I found interesting the influence which perhaps played on his young creative mind by a certain children's author whose books he apparently read, with the last name of Belloc, B-E-L-L-O-C. I didn't know this name. But when I read Dr. Seuss, I just think there's never been anybody like Dr. Seuss before, but indeed there sort of was.
Well, I wouldn't say that Belloc was a predecessor of that ilk. I think you'd find Charles Lutwidge Dodson, or Lewis Carroll, rather, would be more of the type of predecessor people would recognize. But he took things from different authors because he had this really peculiar memory. He couldn't forget certain things, particularly images. So with the Belloc books, it wasn't so much the text, which was more of a moralistic, teach kids to behave sort of thing. But he remembered the images that Basil Blackwood, or BTB is the artist that did those, he remembered those images. I think you probably remember the images of the goat on atop the mountain. It was just a throwaway image. I have no idea why that stuck with him. But he reproduces that throughout his entire life, and there's probably 50 examples of it.
Hmm. When I was thinking, too, you mentioned the fact that Belloc liked to often make up
yes.
names or words in order to finish out a rhyme.
Yes, absolutely.
And of course, that's also a familiar hallmark of a lot of Dr. Seuss's works.
Yes, clearly. He absorbed all of these things, as well as from other children's authors. Peter Newell, who did the whole book, for example, he got a certain playfulness out of them, and he did learn things like creating words, obviously. But I think he'd agree, he took it to a whole different level when
right.
with
well,
his own work.
Well, and you say that he sort of rebelled against the what you call kind of the puritanical tone of a lot of that children's literature. I mean, he might have taken visual images or certain styles of writing from it, but then it was towards the end of a wholly different and refreshing sort of moral or point to the story.
Yes, clearly. As a matter of fact, I've learned that in England and in Canada in particular, Dr. Seuss has sort of this anarchic persona. People really like this countercultural sort of feel that they get from him. And at first, I thought it might just have to do with a character like the Cat in the Hat, who isn't your traditional character, allows people to mess up a house rather than teaching them to keep it clean. But it was more than that. When you look at it fundamentally, he has this slightly anti-authoritarian influence where any character in power, whether it be a teacher or particularly any ruler, a king, whether it's the Kingdom of Did or whether it's Yertle even as a non-human ruler, they're either idiots or they're incompetent, and it takes a kid to come along and show them the right way, show them how things should be done. I think that people appreciate that part of it as being a different take, a refreshing take, and a more normal take. I mean, the Dick and Jane series that people are used to reading back at that time, they're like sickly sweet kids. Nobody's like that.
Hmm.
So you get a whole different sort of version. And then, again, the types of things he's teaching them, once he gets their attention, to the idea of tolerance, that the person's a person no matter how small, that it doesn't matter if you have a star on your belly or not, that we should be tolerant and fight against prejudice. What more important things for the fate of the world, if you will, would you want to teach a child?
Charles D. Cohen, his fascinating book is called The Seuss, The Whole Seuss and Nothing But the Seuss. A visual biography of Theodore Seuss Geisel. I'm Gregory Berg.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and a host of the morning show. It is 8:59. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio. My name is Dave McGrath. We'll check the forecast for the National Weather Service and join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming. Should be a cloudy morning, a partly sunny afternoon, a high today of 28. Here are the numbers just in, not much change at all. 22 degrees, both were seen in Kenosha. Now 18 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. The wind comes from the west at 14 miles per hour with a wind chill this morning of 9 degrees above zero. It is 9